Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. Wheatsfield Co-op in Ames has a program called Change for Community. When you check out, you have the option of rounding up to the nearest dollar to donate that money to the monthly Change for Community recipient. And this month, that recipient is KHOI. So when you are checking out at Wheatsfield, please remember KHOI and say yes to contribute to Change for the Community. The weather forecast for this week looks pretty good. We finally had a break from the rain this weekend, and that will continue at least through midweek. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday will be sunny and in the 50s, and even up to 62 today. Then Thursday and Friday will be a little wetter, with showers on Thursday and light rain on Friday. But then by next weekend, we will see the sun return with temperatures remaining in the 50s. So it looks to be a relatively quiet week with some nice autumn weather here in Ames, good weather for enjoying the fall colors and for raking leaves. On today's show, we will hear an interview with Sebastian Braun, the director of the American Indian Studies Program at ISU, and he'll be talking about the inaccurate narratives that persist about Native Americans and colonization, particularly in relation to fall holidays like Thanksgiving and Columbus Day. We'll also be talking with Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, but first, we have news from Dennis Hart.
It's good to be back here on this Monday. The story that had lots of people around the state talking this past week involved $1 billion. That was the jackpot on the line this past Friday in the Mega Millions drawing. And no one had all the numbers needed to claim that billion. So that means the next drawing, tomorrow night, will be worth an incredible $1.6 billion. Politics also made news around Iowa last week. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and her Democratic challenger Fred Hubble met in their second and third face-to-face debates. The second one took place Wednesday in Sioux City. They sparred over three main issues: abortion, medical cannabis, and sexual harassment in state government. Reynolds said she signed into law the bill that outlawed nearly all abortions in the state because, in her words, "I said I would never stop fighting on behalf of the unborn." Hubble said, in his words, "I am an unabashed supporter of Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court decision that gave women the right to an abortion." As for medical cannabis, Hubble said he would sign legislation lifting a cap of 3% on one of the key components of cannabis oil. Reynolds said she supported the rules already in place. And Hubble accused Reynolds of failing to address problems of sexual harassment in state government. Reynolds said, in her words, "You can change the culture and you can lead by example." Reynolds and Hubble's last scheduled debate took place yesterday, Sunday morning, in Davenport. They discussed a variety of issues, including abortion, taxes, immigration, education, and health care. Reynolds pointed to what she said was going well in Iowa: low unemployment and lower taxes. Hubble focused on what he said needed to be fixed. As he put it, building an economy that works for everybody. Election Day is November 6th. Also in politics, Vice President Mike Pence showed up in Des Moines to campaign for David Young, the incumbent Republican in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District. Pence said if Young loses to Democratic Party challenger Cindy Axne in next month's election, the Republicans could lose their majority in the House of Representatives. And one more political note, Colorado's Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper also traveled to Des Moines last week, telling Democrats there that there's a high probability he will run for president. Also last week, a rare polio-type mystery illness that can paralyze children was confirmed in two Iowa cases and was suspected of one in Nebraska. The illness is called acute flaccid myelitis. Symptoms can include sudden muscle weakness, drooping eyelids, and difficulty swallowing and breathing. Both Iowa patients were younger than 18 and were treated and then released from hospitals in western and central Iowa. Also last week, word that a 19-year-old member of the Iowa National Guard who was deployed to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba died in a swimming accident there. He was identified as PFC Matthew H. Cox. Meanwhile, there was word that Iowa's new family planning program is providing fewer services, such as contraception, 1 year after state lawmakers excluded Planned Parenthood clinics and other abortion providers from receiving funding. The program is paying for fewer than a third as many birth control pills, hormonal implants, and related services as its previous version. Also last week, one of the big stories statewide was that the man accused of fatally stabbing Iowa State University student Celia Barkina Rosamena pleaded not guilty. 22-year-old Colin Richards entered his written plea in Story County District Court. Richards remains in jail on a $5 million cash bond. His trial is set to begin January 15th. If he's convicted of murder, he faces life in prison without parole. Still on the court beat, a former Iowa youth basketball coach could face up to 180 years behind bars after investigators found him in possession of nude images or videos of at least 400 boys. Greg Stephen of Monticello, Iowa, pleaded guilty on Thursday to 5 counts of sexual exploitation of minors and 1 count each of possessing and transporting child pornography. Also last week, additional police officers were at Ames High School on Monday after police received 2 out-of-state calls Saturday morning reporting a threat, which the callers said they saw online. Ames School District officials said authorities found no direct connection to the threat and to any student or community member. School administrators called the need to send messages out about threats an unfortunate reflection of our time. Also last week, there was word that FBI agents had executed search warrants at the A1 Iowa dental offices in Ankeny and Urbandale. No reason was given for the raids, and there was no word what authorities found. Meanwhile, word last week that a West Des Moines dentist had agreed not to be alone with female patients, while state regulators decide what to do about allegations that he made lewd remarks and advances to women in his office. The Iowa Dental Board alleges that dentist Phelan Thomas demonstrated a pattern of making improper remarks to and exhibiting inappropriate behavior with female patients and dental students. Thomas said he believes there is no merit to the charges. Also last week, word that Grundy County agreed to pay $500,000 to settle a case involving an Iowa man who was left hanging from a bed sheet tied around his neck for more than 13 minutes while a Grundy County jailer stood outside his cell. 26-year-old Jared Slinker was pronounced dead shortly after the incident in 2016. Any chance for life-saving efforts was delayed because the county staffed 1 employee to work at the jail at a time. Slinker suffered from mental illness and drug addiction, and his doctor and family members had shared concerns about his suicidal behavior with jail staff. Meanwhile, a grand jury has declined to indict a Polk County sheriff's deputy who shot and killed a Wisconsin man after a chase that ended in Altoona in July. Deputy Ryan Phillips fatally shot Isaiah Hayes after a chase that began when Hayes drove away from a traffic stop. There was also word last week that an Altoona police officer who had resigned in April to avoid being fired has now been charged with 5 felonies. 39-year-old Joshua James Copeland was booked into jail on 2 counts of felonious misconduct in office, 2 counts of forgery, and 1 count of possession of a controlled substance. Copeland was a 9-year veteran of the Altoona police force. Another story last week, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that the State Department of Transportation issued thousands of speeding tickets to drivers, even though it lacked the authority to do so before a legislative fix was adopted last year. The court unanimously decided that the law before 2017 gave DOT motor enforcement officers the power to issue citations only for registration, size, weight load, and operating authority violations, not for speeding. In another story, a Des Moines area woman who has been found guilty of stealing from past employers and who is accused of ripping off several more was reported to be in jail again for violating probation. Priscilla Hieronymus was said to have provided a false last name to get hired earlier this month at the Central States Pain Clinic in West Des Moines. Also last week, an update on the incident that resulted in the death of an employee at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls last month. An engineering report blamed the failure of a pipe cap for the massive steam release that fatally injured university steam fitter Kevin Bly as he was testing the steam distribution service for the dining hall. There was also word last week that Iowa's top election official said he's working with law enforcement to respond to unverified reports that the state's voter registration list is being sold on the Internet. Secretary of State Paul Pate's office said Iowa's voter registration list is for sale legally through the Secretary of State's website, but state law prohibits its commercial use or resale and limits use of the list. Also last week, construction started on a world-class skate park in downtown Des Moines. That skate park will have 65,000 square feet. It will be the biggest in the Midwest and the second biggest in the United States. It's expected to open next summer, just 1 year before skateboarding makes its Olympic debut at the 2020 Games in Tokyo. The skate park will span 5 acres of riverfront property near 2nd Avenue and School Street in Des Moines. It has the potential to attract 40,000 skaters a year and the capability to host local and national skating events. It will cost $3.5 million to build. Meanwhile, a ribbon-cutting ceremony took place last Friday in northwest Iowa to mark the official end of construction for U.S. Highway 20, exactly 60 years after the first segment of that highway was completed. The last stretch of four-lane U.S. 20 covers 40 miles. The first section opened October 19, 1958. The remainder of the expressway project has slowly progressed in bits and pieces across northern Iowa ever since. Weather also made news around Iowa last week, and not just because of the early snowfall in parts of the state. Researchers reported that Tornado Alley may be shifting a bit to the east. They say over the past four decades, tornadoes have increased over a big part of the Midwest and Southeast, while they've gone down a bit in the Central and Southern Plains, a region traditionally known as Tornado Alley that includes Oklahoma and Texas. And you may remember the story we told you about last week about the Ankeny woman charged with animal neglect after authorities said she wound bungee cords around two of her dogs' mouths to keep them quiet. This past Friday, the dogs, named Maddie and Bo, were put up for adoption by the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. And, of course, college football made big news around the state this past weekend. Iowa State's football team had the weekend off, but the university found out that the Big 12 Conference was going to fine it and publicly reprimand the school after fans stormed the field on October 13th to celebrate the Cyclones' upset win over West Virginia. The university is being fined $25,000 for its handling of post-game protocols. Iowa State said it would appeal the fine, but late last week, the Big 12 upheld that fine. Meanwhile, the University of Iowa was in action, and the Hawkeyes defeated Maryland 23-0. And the University of Northern Iowa defeated South Dakota State 24-9. And that is your summary of the past week's news from around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday with a look at what made news in the pages of the Ames Tribune.
I saw you standing with the wind and the rain in your face. And you were thinking about the wisdom of the leaves and their grace. When the leaves come falling down, yes, September when the leaves come falling down. And at night the moon is shining on a clear, cloudless sky. But when the evening shadows fall, I'll be there by your side. When the leaves come falling down, in September when the leaves come falling down. Follow me down, follow me down, follow me down till a place beside the garden and the wall. Follow me down, follow me now, till the space before the twilight and the dawn. Oh, the last time I saw Paris in the streets, in the rain, and as I walk along the boulevards with you once again, the leaves come falling down in September when the leaves come falling down. down. Follow me down. Follow me down to the place between the garden and the wall. Follow me down. Follow me down to the space between the twilight and the dawn. And as I'm looking at the color of the leaves in your hand, as we're listening to Chet Baker on the beach in the sand, when the leaves come falling down. Oh, in September, when the leaves come falling down. Oh, when the leaves come falling down. Yeah, in September, when the leaves come falling down. When the leaves come falling down. In September, when the leaves come falling down. Falling down in September in the rain, when the leaves come falling down. When the leaves come falling down in September in the rain, when the leaves come falling down.
That was When the Leaves Come Falling Down by Van Morrison, one of my favorite autumn songs. Among our autumn traditions in the U.S. are two holidays, Thanksgiving and Columbus Day, both of which are associated with certain stories or narratives about discovery, colonization, and Native Americans. A few weeks ago, I interviewed a first-grade teacher in Ames about how she engages her students in learning about Native Americans. And today we have an interview with Sebastian Braun, the director of the American Indian Studies Program at ISU. The reason I invited you in to speak with us, particularly at this time of year, is because it's Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. Right. And so I wanted to have a conversation with you about the way those holidays portray Native Americans and what's problematic about that.
Sure. I mean, so as you said, I'm not going to speak what they mean for Americans, Native peoples. But the way they're portrayed, and I think the narrative that they tell is really something that should be discussed, yeah. Maybe if you could start with Thanksgiving, that's an easier one, I think, at least for me to discuss.
Okay.
I mean, Thanksgiving as a holiday, right, celebrates this first, basically the narrative is that it celebrates this first encounter between the pilgrims and the native people. And what I always tell my students is that if they remember Thanksgiving, it's the native people who give food to the pilgrims and introduce them to agriculture. In the New World, at least, or in the so-called New World for the Europeans, and who share with them and are open and welcoming. And it's that maybe we should celebrate. And most often, however, that narrative is sometimes turned around in terms of Europeans come here to help native people and to bring them civilization and to make them understand how things really work. And while that is a very frequent narrative, it is one that goes absolutely to the opposite of what actually happened.
And is there evidence that the kind of coming together of the pilgrims and Native Americans, there is evidence that there actually was that kind of coming together where the Native Americans actually did assist the settlers in learning how to do agriculture here in this climate and continent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if that, you know, encounter didn't happen as it is portrayed, mm-hmm. right, all we have to do is look at Iowa. I mean, what do we plant in Iowa? Corn. Well, where does corn come from? Well, it was domesticated by Native peoples in Mexico and then was long planted in Iowa before the first Europeans showed up. And so, yeah, that's all the evidence I think we need here in Iowa to see how that these encounters did happen.
But the more common narrative is that the Native Americans knew very little, and it was the Europeans who were bringing knowledge and a different way of life to them in a savior kind of way.
Yes, exactly right. And I mean, they absolutely brought a different way of life, of course, right? But they also, I mean, they imposed that on Native peoples, and I think that is, of course, part of the problem. And I think the narratives that exist, as you said, that, you know, the Europeans brought, helped Native peoples, is kind of the legitimization for imposing this different way of life upon them, right? What right does somebody have to impose their own culture, their own way of life on somebody else, to change their societies, to live on their land, to prohibit them from living their culture? Well, the most popular legitimization for that is, but we are helping you to see the light by doing this, right? We are helping you to survive. We are helping you to be successful. We want to improve your life. Live like us and you will be better off, mm-hmm. right? And so that is exactly that narrative.
So inherent in that is the assumption that the Indian way of life, their culture, was deficient.
Exactly.
In many ways.
Yeah.
All ways, really.
In all ways, yeah. I mean, if you read Columbus, to come to Columbus,
okay.
right? Columbus, you know, establishes that very well. In his journals, he constantly talks of Native peoples that he encounters in the Caribbean as having no clothes, having no religion, not even another religion, but because it is different from Christianity, no religion, having no language because it is so different that he doesn't understand it, so it cannot be a language, right? Having no laws because they're different from his laws and he doesn't understand them, so there can't be any real laws, so they have no laws, and having no property because the way that property is handled is so different that he doesn't understand it, and so it cannot be real property. So you have this ethnocentric worldview, right? This worldview that my cultural standards are the only ones that matter, and therefore I can measure everybody else by my own cultural standards. And the judgment by Europeans, and Columbus is just the first one who does that, right? The judgment by Europeans is always, they don't do what we do. They don't do the right religion, so they have no religion. They don't speak the right language, so they have no language. And that's kind of the beginning of this assessment. They have no civilization. They have no culture. They lack in anything.
And we know this from Columbus's own writings and the writings of other people who were in his ships.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In Columbus's own journals, the way that he describes Native people is like that, yeah.
And yet we have a very different portrayal of Columbus in the narrative that goes along with Columbus is very different than that.
Right. So I'm not from the United States.
And
Columbus Day doesn't register, you know, because I didn't grow up with it. So I'm always surprised that my kids don't have to go to school, for example, right? I think part of what makes this amazement so great for me is that Columbus didn't discover, if he discovered anything, but never set foot in the United States. And so the celebration of Columbus Day in the United States is something that needs, I think, a lot of explanation. The fact that Columbus is so sometimes revered as like kind of almost the father of the nation or something like that, like, is historically absolutely incorrect.
Because he basically landed on islands in the Caribbean, Cuba,
right.
And what was called Hispaniola.
Several of those smaller islands,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so when he did land on those islands, he encountered the native people there who are called the Taino, is that correctly?
Some of them, yeah.
Pronounced?
Yes.
And so what is known about them?
So the Taino are the ones that we know most about. We don't know much about other native peoples in the Caribbean, and we don't know too much about the Taino because within about 50 to 75 years, most of these people were dead. And I mean, they were basically extinct as people. There were no survivors of these people, in part because of the direct treatment from the Spanish, and in part because they were used as slaves on the plantations that the Spanish started to build, and many of them committed suicide. Many of them tried to run away, but had no longer any way to support themselves in because their settlements were gone or controlled by the Spanish, and quite a few of them were directly killed by the Spanish. When we look at the Caribbean, we have archaeological evidence for native peoples there. We have what the Spanish wrote in their journals about them, but that's in almost every case, that's it.
And do we know what happened when Columbus and his men actually encountered the Taino?
Yeah, we pretty much know that. Yeah, because you know, the Spanish thought they were doing the right thing, so they had no reason to not describe what they were doing. And so Columbus was looking for gold. Columbus was a very medieval person, if you want. So he knew that there was gold in the Caribbean because there were parrots. And Columbus was convinced that there was a causal relationship between parrots and gold, because he knew that from West Africa. And in West Africa, there are parrots and there is gold. And so he put the two together. And so he was looking for gold. He was convinced that he was in China or somewhere around there. And so he actually did not really discover a new world. He was, his whole life, even after the fourth voyage, he was absolutely convinced that he was, but in somewhere in East Asia. And so just as he was convinced of that, he was convinced there was gold. And so if the native people didn't tell him where the gold was, because there was no gold, it couldn't be that there was no gold. There had to be gold, and they wouldn't tell him. And so he tortured them until they would tell him. And he's very clear about that. The Spanish had dogs, which proved to be, for them, a great way of controlling native people. They set them free, and they were trained attack dogs. They ripped native people to pieces. There is one story that one of the Spanish officers wanted to see if his sword was sharpened enough, and he tried that out by cutting down native people, basically. And you can see what the value of native people was for the Spanish. In effect, because they had no, right, because they thought they had no religion, no law, no culture, they were not human, mm-hmm. right? And so they were treated as animals.
So they were just considered expendable or worthless unless they could provide information on
exactly.
where gold was.
Yeah.
That is so different than the way Columbus is often portrayed.
Yes.
And from a education viewpoint, you mentioned that children will have off in many locations, off from school, a holiday. But leading up to Columbus, I remember when I was in school, there were all kinds of traditions associated with both Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, whether it was dressing up as pilgrims and Native Americans, or coloring in pictures of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. So do you have any sense if a lot of that has been changed, or does some of that still exist?
I think there are a lot of teachers who are really trying to do things differently today. And I, from what I hear, there's still some of the pilgrims and Indians and, you know, things like that. And I think some of these things still persist, not because teachers think those are great activities to do with their children, but because teachers do not have an alternative, that they would know, you know, how to bring these stories to life in a different way. And I think that's really a huge obstacle that exists, is that we have not produced the materials that would give teachers who want to do something else a guidance on what they could do, on what they maybe should do. And I think that's why oftentimes even teachers who want to change things, they don't know how to do it.
So the need for resources and preparation for the teachers to know how to broach these subjects and
yeah.
other kinds of activities, especially
yeah.
with different ages of students, because obviously it would have to differ with first graders versus high school students.
Right, exactly. And right now, I mean, if Thanksgiving is simply pilgrims and Indians meeting and you want to do something with Thanksgiving, then K through 12, you play pilgrims and Indians, right? Well, if you would, for example, look at the consequences of that encounter, you know, you could maybe have a range of things in increasing complexity and talk about those narratives with increasing complexity, looking at what comes out of this encounter, looking at, you know, treaties, looking at the present situation and kind of like, you know, scaffold that through the grades. But how many teachers, you know, how many teachers take Native history classes?
Mm-hmm.
How many teachers take African American history classes, right? There is this dominant historical narrative, and it is there for a reason, right? It's the origin story of the United States as a country. And how much more content can we stuff into teacher education? I mean, those are all important questions too.
A growing number of cities and states, and I was surprised to learn that this is now true of Iowa. Other jurisdictions
yes.
had done that. Some states,
yeah. Yeah.
a few states, and a number of cities and towns had changed the name to Indigenous Peoples Day. What are your thoughts on that?
So on one hand, I think it's great that we have Indigenous Peoples Day. On the other hand, if it's just Indigenous Peoples Day and you know, there's one day in a year that we kind of remember in some ways that there are Indigenous peoples around, that doesn't change too much. It's nice to, it's, you know, again, I don't want to minimize that, mm-hmm. but it's a symbol, right? It's mm-hmm. a symbol, perhaps, of change. The interesting thing about this change is that the real reason why people celebrate Columbus Day in the United States is because Italian Americans were discriminated against in the early 20th century, and they needed kind of like a positive role model to show other Americans that they were not uncivilized and they should be treated in equality with other peoples. And so they said, well, who better than Columbus? And so he was appropriated for this purpose, right? So if you have this holiday that was originating in this effort to erase discrimination, that has now become a symbol of discrimination, and we're replacing it with a holiday that fulfills that role now for a different group of people. In some ways, I wish not that we would continue to celebrate Columbus Day, at least not in the form that it's mm-hmm. being done, but that we would not now construct this conflict between groups of people again, because we're replacing one by the other. And I think a lot of the backlashes that come out against Indigenous people sometimes are rooted exactly in that. It's in the fear that if we now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day and we take away Columbus Day, it's seen as a sign that somehow people are going to take away people's rights and replacing mm-hmm. them with other people's rights. And it's a zero-sum game, and it doesn't lead anywhere. So I'm all for Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm critical, hesitant about Columbus Day, at least the way it has been celebrated. But I wish we could simply remember the actual history of what happened both to Italian Americans in this country and how they became integrated, or why, or what they had to give up to become integrated into this society, how much struggle that was. And we should also remember, of course, what Indigenous peoples had to endure and have to go through in efforts to gain equality in this society.
We often hear about what happened with the Native Americans on the East Coast.
Yes.
And we also hear a lot about some of the big battles and so on, whether, you know, the Little Bighorn and, yeah. you know, those kinds of things. But you don't hear a lot about what happened in the Midwest, in Iowa.
Yes.
And I know that's asking you to give an entire history course, it could be.
Yeah, I think, you know,
I mean, in Iowa.
Yeah. One of the reasons why we don't hear about Iowa, right, is that there are not these famous battles in Iowa. And it's true, right? That is true. What happened in Iowa is more what we might call structural violence that is exerted on Native peoples. Not direct violence, but structural violence. Because what happened in Iowa is that Indigenous peoples, Native societies, Native groups, American Indian tribes, were removed from Iowa through a treaty process that was highly unequal. That is, what usually happened in the Midwest is that tribes had become dependent on trade goods, but the fur trade had moved on, right? So as the fur trade moved on and tribes still needed these trade goods, they incurred debts. And treaties then came in and the United States government basically said, look, we're going to pay off your debts to these traders in exchange for your land. Thomas Jefferson basically planned this out very consciously after Louisiana Purchase. I mean, he basically proposes this policy. And at the time it comes to Iowa is from the 18-teens through the 1840s. And so one of the reasons why Iowa as a state starts to exist in 1846 is that by 1845, most Native peoples had been removed mm-hmm. from Iowa, apart from like northern Iowa, which is still Dakota Territory until 1851. And so it's this process that is often forgotten because people don't want to remember treaties. People don't, you know, but there were no famous battles. There was none of this exciting history, you know, that we often focus on. And instead, what happened is that between 1800 and 1850, right, in those 50 years, what happens in Iowa is that you go from absolutely sovereign native nations who are independent, who have their own cultures, their own societies, their own laws, make their own decisions about their future, you go to an absolute absence of native peoples in Iowa. Until a few years later, then the Meskwaki are able to purchase lands in Iowa and come back and establish the Meskwaki settlement. I mean, so if somebody was 10 years old in 1800, right, and was imbued in this vibrant culture and in this vibrant societies, by the time that they were an old person, they were living in exile on small reservations, no longer in their homeland, in a different environment. Their societies had to adapt to these different environments, to smaller lands. They were absolutely dependent on the American government and therefore had to do whatever the federal government told them to do. If you think about that in this kind of personal narrative, it makes it clear how much upheaval happened at that time and how much, you know, again, not direct violence necessarily, but how much structural violence was exerted on these societies.
Yeah. And if people are interested in learning more about a more realistic understanding of what happened to Native Americans here in Iowa, are there any books or films?
There are books. There's a really good book by Lance Foster, who's the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, which is Indians of Iowa. It's just called Indians of Iowa. And it gives an overview, at least, of kind of like a very basic overview, but really a great overview of kind of like who was here, what native peoples were here, and sort of how they lived. That's a great place to start for anybody there. And if anybody wants to know which resources are there, you feel free to contact me.
And you mentioned that you're not from the U.S.
Yes.
Then how did you become interested in Native Americans?
So I'm from Europe. And when I talk to many people here, also native peoples, and as, you know, we talk about what we did as children, right? And oftentimes people say, well, we played Indians and cowboys. And many native peoples have told me, well, we always wanted to be the cowboys because we were told that, that it wasn't good to be Indian, right? And it was the opposite in where I grew up. We also played Indians and cowboys. But we always wanted to be the Indians because we knew that the cowboys were the bad guys. I'm saying this because I think there is this narrative in Europe where the roles are reversed. There's a critical view, a much more critical view of the American government. What people know is that the Indians were not treated right. And it's so interesting to me that there's this difference, right? I didn't start out wanting to focus on Native America. I was focusing on Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, and that's what I was going to do as I'm an anthropologist. Then it was 1992, and so 1992, we had this seminar at the university, 500 years of oppression, right? And again, there's this different narrative, right? And I kind of became more interested in Native North American.
Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure.
And thank you for filling us in and giving us a lot to think about in terms of what's a more realistic understanding of the Native American experience, especially as these holidays roll around.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sebastian Braun, the director of the American Indian Studies Program at ISU. And this is Local Talk on KHOI 89.1 FM. Keeping with our autumn theme, dark-eyed juncos are passing through Iowa at this time of year, and Pat Schlarbaum prepared a phenology about them.
Phenology is writing in a journal nature's happenings when they occur. The first robin of spring or the last osprey of autumn are noted to compare from year to year. Today's phenology is about dark-eyed juncos. With autumn frost, new arrivals of these birds to our north are joining us. Dark-eyed juncos are neat, even flashy little sparrows that flit about forest floors of the western mountains in Canada, then flood the rest of North America for winter. These birds carry a wildness where wolves, eagles, and moose survive, so that's how they earn their name, snowbirds. They're easy to recognize by their charcoal color with white bellies and crisp markings, and the bright white tail feathers they habitually flash in flight. And of course their eyes are dark, hence the name dark-eyed juncos. One of the most abundant forest birds of North America, you'll see juncos on woodland walks, as well as in flocks at your feeders or on the ground beneath them. Adults generally have gray heads, necks, and breasts, grayer brown backs and wings, and a white belly, but show a confusing amount of variation in plumage details. The white outer tail feathers flashed distinctively in flight and while hopping on the ground. But Junco fledglings, or young of the year, heads are generally quite uniform in color already, and initially their bills still have conspicuous yellow edges to the gape. The gape are the remains of the fleshy wattles at the corners of the mouth that guide the parents when they feed the nestlings. Young of the year have breasts that are streaked brown. Their calls include tick sounds and a very high-pitched tinkling chips. It is known among bird language practitioners as an excellent bird to study for learning bird language. Junco is the Spanish term for rush from the Latin juncus. Its modern scientific name means winter junco, from Latin hyemalis means of the winter. So Juncus hyemalis is their scientific name. Juncos can only persist in their favorite habitat, coniferous or mixed forest. Northern birds migrate further south, arriving in their winter quarters between October and November, and leaving to breed from mid-March onwards, with almost all gone by the end of May or so. They seem to linger each spring. They mainly eat insects and seeds and love black oil sunflower seeds at our bird feeders. Often the dark-eyed juncos arrive with additional migrants, like white-throated and white-crowned sparrows. When disturbed, the entire flock suddenly flies up to a tree, usually perching in the open and calling in aggravation at the intrusion. It's the time of year to enjoy these birds in the coming days as autumn slips through glorious days of the season. And that's our phenology for dark-eyed juncos for today. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
Thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for that phenology. And we've been joined in the studio now by Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thanks for coming in this morning, Crystal. And you're going to tell us about a lot of events and things this fall that are still to come here in Ames and the surrounding area. So what are we going to start with?
We still have our Smithsonian exhibit that's going on downtown, so be sure to catch that. It's called Hometown Teams, How Sports Shape America. And like I said, it goes on through Sunday, November 11th, and you can see it at four different locations: at the Ames Public Library, at the Octagon Center for the Arts, the ISU Design on Main, and the Ames Historical Society. So a great exhibit. It's, you know, something a long time in the coming. The Smithsonian part of it, I mean, it just speaks to the caliber and quality of what you can learn. And so besides a kind of a national touch, they also have a lot of local stories to share. Mm-hmm. So we encourage you to check that
hometown
out.
Sports
hometown
sports connections.
Right.
And I know that there were some special events in conjunction with that. Have those all passed?
I think they almost have all passed.
Okay,
I was just looking at them. But the exhibit is still open through November 11th. So, I'm bringing my folks this weekend. So,
good for visitors.
Be sure to check that out. As you know, the holiday season is coming up and approaching, so it's never too early to talk about snow, but let's talk about snow magic. And Ames Main Street will be kicking off their holiday season, the snow magic season, and starting on Friday, November 9th, they're going to be having their tree lighting and their campaign kickoff, and that will be right downtown. At Tom Evans Park, it starts at 5 to 8, but the tree lighting begins at 6 p.m. They're going to have children's activities. Santa Claus arrives around 5:30. Hot chocolate, free hot chocolate, so be sure to check that out. And then they'll have things all through the month of November and into December, special events. And so we encourage you to keep a lookout for Ames Main Street and some of the things that are coming along that way. So
that is starting soon. Wow. Is it already November?
It's already November. I know. Isn't that crazy? There are still some things that you can check out for the holiday season as well. You know, basketball season is going to start to kick off, so some people are anxious for that. So be sure to check out not only the Iowa State University basketball season, but the local Ames High season for those of you who are basketball fans. And there's also another big event coming up. The Ames Foundation has their big celebration, and they do a lot of great work around the community. Maybe they're most known for their tree planting. So be sure to give them a shout out and check them out on November 9th if you'd like to celebrate the work that they're doing. I'd also like to point out that that coming up at Ames City Auditorium in November is Elf the Musical Junior. And so that's also to kind of get you in the holiday spirit. It's from November 9th through the 18th. And so a lot of opportunities to see what's going on. And it's presented by Story Theater Company. And so a lot of the kids, the ages of the youth are from 5 to 18 years old. And some of you know the story from the movies and on TV, but be sure to check that out. It'll be a great way to lead you into getting in the holiday spirit right here. And they perform at the City Auditorium for this one.
So there are children in the play?
There are children in the play.
Okay.
Yep, and they also have some evening shows as well as some matinees that I encourage you.
So that's a good family event.
Children
could also go and see.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I'm just clicking on my calendar here for you. Also, I just want to also point out that if you can go to our calendar, thinkings.com, we've got a lot of things cooking there that we never have enough time to mention.
ThinkAims.com, and we'll have a link to that on our website.
Right, right. But also check out great things like if you're interested in some great music, the M Shop at the Memorial Union puts on all kinds of eclectic things. They'll be talking jazz in November, on November 12th. And they will be highlighted by the ISU Department of Music and Theater. So I think that's a great opportunity to check out what are the students doing. And that starts at 7 o'clock on November 12th.
And that's at the
M Shop in the Union. And then as we kind of get ready to lead into Thanksgiving, all kinds of great things happening. One thing I do want to point out is the Story County Philanthropy Day. Will be happening in November, on November 15th. They'll be at the Gateway Hotel and Conference Center. And it's just a great way that they're going to celebrate all that we've been doing in our Story County and our community. And just a great celebration to find out what they're doing and how they've been changing the world. So check that out if you're interested in participating and celebrating with them on November 15th.
Is that an organization that's already in existence?
Yep. So Story County Philanthropy. I'll give you their website, storycountyphilanthropy.org. And they really just kind of celebrate some groups, some individuals, and their goal is to celebrate all that, showing appreciation for all that has been accomplished in the name of giving, and to show that there's still much more to do in Story County. And so they'll be celebrating some of their successes on November 15th. I'd also encourage you to check out a fun thing that might be going on at Crafty Cocktail Night out at Ryman Gardens. There's still fun to be had out at the Ryman Gardens. Even though it's getting a little cooler, they still have a great exhibit and we'll be decorating for the holidays. And this is one where you can make a creative project. And on November 15th, they're going to be doing test tube nature pendants. So what a great interesting idea on how to bring nature into something that you can make.
So I imagine these are these little glass test tubes mm-hmm. that then you make an arrangement or something
right,
in them?
Yep, they're repurposed test tubes, and you can make nature collections, and you can wear them as a necklace, or you can use it to decorate your home. So they'll have you can use butterfly wings or other natural items that are gathered at the gardens to help make this fun little craft.
And you're reusing test tubes.
Reusing test tubes, right. So, yeah.
Is that more for adults?
One would be more for adults. Okay. So that's an evening event. And so, yes, that is a little bit for the grown-ups. Yep. I'd also encourage you to check out I was just talking about this with a friend this weekend about Cyclone Cinema. They offer free to the public. It's not just for students. On weekends when school is in session, they also Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they have a 7 o'clock and a 10 p.m. showing of a movie at 101 Carver Hall. again, free to the public. It's for they usually do like a kind of a family themed movie one weekend, maybe a little bit more grown-up movie the next weekend. So get yourself to Carver Hall. And coming up in November, they're going to be doing the very popular Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again musical. So we encourage you to check out their schedule and take advantage of a free opportunity to see some movies.
And they do a different film each week. I've gone a couple times.
They have. So while school's in session, they do do a different movie every weekend.
Yeah, and I know that they sell very reasonably priced popcorn. I'm always so amazed when you go to the movie theater and a bag of popcorn costs $6.
Right.
But they sell very reasonably priced
exactly.
Popcorn.
So another thing, there's still time to get lots of pumpkins. If I've been racing ahead to the holidays, the last farmer's market will be coming up this weekend. So be sure to check that out. Ames Main Street, it starts at 9 o'clock and they go till 12:30. So if you're looking for the latest pumpkins and holiday crafts and some food, be sure to check it out. The North Grand Farmers Market is still going, so I always say make a swing of it through the town and hit both of them. The North Grand one is in the JCPenney parking lot. And we'll sure miss that when that gets over with later this month.
It's a great place to buy things, but it's also a destination.
A destination,
Something to do.
Right.
Do you know when trick-or-treating is happening?
Well, I was
in the Main Street area.
I just was looking that up. So there'll be trick-or-treating, and October 26th is when it'll be going downtown.
So that's, what day is the 26th?
Friday.
And then they'll be having their trick-or-treat throughout the businesses. And then there's also trick-or-treating going on October 31st at the Ames Public Library. They invite you to come into the library on October 31st, wear your costumes, and visit the service desk for a little special treat as well. Yeah. So lots to do. And there's also, you know, in the spirit, there's Malloween at North Grand Mall on the 30th. They'll be having kind of their spooktacular night where you can trick-or-treat inside. And that's on October 30th starting at 5 o'clock. And they're also going to have a special treat with the Story Theater Company will be there as well in costume. And so you can get your picture taken with them and as well as trick-or-treat inside.
Yeah, so there's lots of different times and places that you can take kids to enjoy those kinds of activities.
Right.
Yeah.
And I also want to point out it's the Stevens Auditorium 50th year, celebrating 50 years of performing arts. And they also will have a show on October 30th, kind of a famous musical, Something Rotten. And so we encourage you to check out that show that's coming. And it was a hit on Broadway, and so it'll be October 30th starting at 7:30 p.m. And just another testament to the great caliber of events that the Iowa State Center season at Stevens brings in, the diversity. And so this will be a musical that some people have been eagerly anticipating. And you can also join them for a pre-show dinner if you'd like to right there on their facility at Stevens Auditorium before the show. So lots going on. Before as we get into fall and into the holiday season.
And then starting into the next holiday season.
It never ends, that's for sure.
And remind us again where people can get information on all of this.
Right. They can go to thinkgames.com and then click on calendar in our upper right-hand corner on the website. Okay. And we've got all kinds of things listed for every single day, I think. So much to choose from music to arts and culture, things to do, things to eat, to cooking classes. And you can also check out social media at Sights of Ames, and that's named after our favorite mascot, Cy.
So C-Y-T-E-S.
C-Y-T-E-S of Ames. And we also have events listed on social media as well. And you can always call our office at the Convention and Visitors Bureau at 232-4032. And we'd be glad to walk you through what we've got going or help you find that special event or what you need to do hair names. So
okay,
yeah.
So it's on your site. It's organized as a calendar. So if people know they have guests coming or they're going to need something to do with kids on a certain day, they can look at what's going on.
Absolutely.
On that particular day.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can do a search by the event, or you can go day by day.
Okay,
and figure out what you want to do that day. Yeah.
Well, great.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for filling us in on
Thank
all
you.
That.
Let's get ready for the holidays.
Us know where people can get more information. I've been talking with Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin Al-Kathiri. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard When the Leaves Are Falling Down by Van Morrison. KHOI's fall membership drive will be starting in November, but you can beat the crowds and donate or become a member now. You can do it online. Just go to the website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Or you can call the station at 515-292-2878. Or even better, stop by and meet some of the amazing KHOI volunteers in person. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio. And remember to donate to KHOI. We're the monthly Change for the Community recipient at Wheatsfield.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, providing rebates to customers for upgrading to energy-efficient appliances, lighting, thermostats, and air conditioners. Smart energy rebates help you decrease your power needs, which can lower your electric bills. Learn more from www.cityofames.org/smartenergy.